Group meeting, Saturday, 21st June, 1986. We must go on now to consider the nature. Can you all hear clearly? The nature of the teacher-pupil relationship in ancient India. And what can we learn from actual examples of it? The Brahman guru, the teacher, was a spiritual father and preceptor to the pupil. And this was a relationship of very great kindness towards the pupil all the time. It was a very personal relationship. Usually the pupil lived in the hut where the teacher lived. And quite often these teachers, they were married men, and their wife accompanied them into the forest when they retired into the forest. They were permitted to do that. Condescension of the male, of course. You see, in one of the texts it is said, loving the pupil like his own son and full of attention, he shall teach him the sacred science without hiding anything in the whole law. And he shall not use him for his own purposes to the detriment of his studies, except in times of distress. One might wonder what exactly this thing means. You know, it often happened that a teacher would send a pupil out to do something for him, to get something for him, or this, that, or the other, or do some particular job which was necessary in the household. Well, that was forbidden to the teacher. He couldn't do that, using his pupil for that purpose. This is extracted from the institutes of Manu. Created beings must be instructed in what concerns their welfare without giving them pain, and sweet and gentle speech must be used by the teacher who desires to abide by the sacred law. He, forsooth, whose speech and thoughts are pure and ever perfectly guarded, gains the whole benefit which is conferred by the Vedanta. The Vedanta meaning the end, anta is end, the end of the Veda. That means the culminating point of the Veda. And the culminating point of the Vedas were the Upanishads, of course. Let him not, even though in pain, that is the teacher, let him not, even though in pain, speak words hurtful to others. Let him not injure others in thought or deed. Let him not utter speeches which make others afraid of him, since that will prevent him from gaining heaven. I wonder how many schoolmasters would approve of that. Now, you know that there were the four stages in the life of the pupil. The first was as a student of a Brahmin teacher. When he had finished his studentship, he became a householder.
Thank you.
The Upanishads themselves teach that the student stage should be followed by the householder stage, because if he did not follow with the householder stage, he would not understand so many aspects of human life which it is necessary for the teacher to understand clearly if he is to help that person. The householder stage was followed by the stage of the anchorite, when, having brought up the family, it was his duty at least to have a son to succeed him, who would perform all the necessary household rites and ceremonies and so on after his death. And having brought up the family, roughly round about the age of 48 to 50, he was free to give up the householder stage and become an anchorite. That is to say, he lived in some fairly pleasant meadow which was by a flowing stream. And there would be a hut for him, and there he would live. If his wife desired to accompany him, she was free to do so. The student stage occupied about 12 years or so. And then the householder stage took him up to the age of 48. After that, he was entitled to become an anchorite and teach. And that is, teach the sacred lore. And after that stage was over, probably round about his 70s or 80s maybe, he was free to become a mendicant who gave up everything. He had no possessions whatsoever, no dependents whatsoever, and he just went as the spirit guided. Living on alms, which were freely given by the people of the villages through which he passed. It was considered that it was at this stage that he was fit to reach his true home, the realization of transcendence itself, what was till then a worship of the Supreme, the Absolute, and so forth, was transcended by his own realization of that transcendent consciousness. Sometimes these teachers lived very long years. It is recorded that Mahidasa Aitareya lived to 116 years. And it is not impossible that there were several of them who did live long lives, because we know that even in modern times, people who live in the north of Kashmir, in the Hansa district, easily reach 90, and Sir Robert McCarrison found them playing about in the snow when they were over a century old. You see, they live very austere, very healthy lives, and they can do these things. In fact, it was that which induced Sir Robert to investigate how do these people in a country where there was famine and difficulty and so forth, right up in the north of Kashmir, how do they manage to live such long lives? And he investigated their food, and that started practically the first scientific investigations which ended up with the discovery of vitamins and the place that vitamins had in preserving good health and so forth. Rather interesting. Now, when the student completed his 12-year pupilage, his teacher advised him to marry a girl fit for his family and who was dear to him. Live the life of the householder for 25 years and then become an anchorite, so that it could be anything between the age of 37 and up to 50 that he lived the householder's life. Strong, healthy bodies and trained minds, skills that were needed for a citizen's life in the world as Brahman, or as king, or administrator, or warrior, or merchant, or agriculturist, sound morals and the realization of the supreme as the spiritual goal of life, these were the objectives of both the teacher and the pupil. Now you'll notice that it was not only the children of Brahmins who came to the Brahmin teacher. He as a teacher was well versed in everything, in political philosophy, history, in the arts of the warrior. For instance, in the Bhagavad Gita, we know that Drona was the teacher of so many of the warriors engaged in that terrific war. He taught them martial arts and also the art of kingship. And the king in those days had tremendous responsibilities. And it is a fact which is little known that kings were elected. Elective kingship held in those days. His inner cabinet of four consisted of his eldest son, who would be the heir to the throne, the commander-in-chief, the chief priest, and those three, and there was a fourth. Oh, somebody skilled who would be the treasurer, look after the treasury, and so forth. That was his inner cabinet. Of course, there were several officials underneath each one of them. Otherwise, you couldn't manage a whole country's affairs. And countries in those days were roughly the size of Britain. You see, India, as an entire country, including modern Pakistan, the old India, was 36 times the size of England. So it wasn't one country until centuries later, after the time of the Upanishads and the Buddha, centuries later, the first great empire was established. Of course, the usual story, blood and thunder, conquest, and so on. But the emperor, and the emperor started with the Mauryan dynasty around about 325 BC, around about there, the empire started. The emperors were suzerains over the whole land, what we knew as the old India, the whole of India. But each of the conquered peoples, the conquered rulers, were given the responsibility to carry on the affairs of their old country as before. It was a loose confederacy of various states. That was the sort of empire that they had. The guru understood his chela, his pupil, inside out. Because these teachers were very sound psychologists and they were psychiatrists. They had the ability to know a man's nature and character on meeting him or soon after meeting him. And they knew what his real needs were. As far as the spiritual teaching was concerned, it consisted of three parts, three aspects. The first one was called Shravana, which means listening. Shru, the root of the word, means to listen. Now it is rather interesting that in the school of Pythagoras in Greece, some centuries after the period of the Upanishads, more or less contemporary with the Buddha, in the school of Pythagoras, the first 2 years were spent in maintaining perfect silence, apart from saying, "Please pass me the salt," or something like that. Apart from absolute necessities, no word was to be spoken. They were trained to listen very, very carefully. And that training was something which was akin to what Krishnaji has been talking of for 60 years, about seeing and listening. In connection with listening, I have mentioned this several times in our meetings. When one hears the spoken word, and the same applies to reading, when one reads the printed word, one's brain is talking back at what one is reading or what one is hearing. And if in ordinary life we move about and there were no books available in those days, whatsoever you saw, you had to look with total attentiveness. Which meant that you had to see or hear what you were seeing or hearing, note that carefully, and at the same time, note the manner in which the brain kept chattering back at what was seen or heard. To this day, I find it difficult after years of practice, and I'm not young. I find it difficult when I read a book or listen to somebody speaking. My brain is sort of passing remarks upon what is seen or what is read or heard, you see. It's very difficult to stop it because all our conditioning acts as a hindrance to clear and full consciousness of what the senses convey is concerned. You have heard me say this very often. The senses become the cords of communion, but they become the cords of communion only when one has developed the power to be silent. It's very essential. So, and remember that the term guru, the teacher, is the secondary meaning. The term guru literally means heavy-handed. The teacher had, and you know, teachers to this day can be quite heavy-handed with some of their pupils. And the secondary meaning is to teach, to impart. Not only to impart information, but to impart it in such a manner that the pupil is inspired. He is not merely acquiring facts. He is learning to understand the heart of the matter which is being imparted to him. This is a spiritual type of learning. Because if and when the heart of the matter is understood, and it need not be understood purely in terms of concepts and words, but this mysterious spiritual awareness of the heart of the matter is what is aimed at. And that is the real teaching. And that means that the student, the learner, is really inspired. To inspire means to give life. Inspiration gives us life when we breathe. That's the physical counterpart of this psychical, psychological, intellectual, and spiritual inspiration. You may have noticed in your own life experience that time and again you suddenly say to yourself, "Yes, I've got it. I see." You have really seen, and yet, if you were to try to put it into words or a succession of thoughts, you will find it difficult. And yet you have known it. That kind of knowing is a becoming that which is known in consciousness. You become that in consciousness. That is the only worthwhile knowing. And not only in the spiritual life and the spiritual sphere, but in all spheres. When a man and his wife know each other in that sense, that is truly a blessed marriage. It is a marriage which is heaven-born, heaven-decreed, if you like. Because in that knowing, the isolation and separation in consciousness between the between one and the other person, and or between oneself and that which you are knowing or coming to know, you see, that separation is out. In consciousness, you are that thing. You become that thing. See, it really is quite an indescribable experience. But it does happen. You don't lose yourself in that. It is not a loss of self. It is an intensification of the unity of the self with that which up to then was the not self. This is the climax, and this is the expression of holistic consciousness. It's an all-inclusive consciousness. Nothing is excluded. You take in everything. Because we human beings try to exclude this, that and the other, because we think it is bad or not for our own personal benefit or pleasure. Because of that, we are in a state of constant conflict. But to be free of that state of constant conflict, we have to accept not as a mere intellectual acceptance or as an imposed morality that I ought to accept, but because it has grown into a true psycho-spiritual reality. You are at one with the other in consciousness, and that is pure love. Pure, it's transcendent love in the real sense. Transcendent because it has gone beyond, entirely beyond, what human beings in the all over the world know or think of as love. So now, Shravana, hearing, was the first stage. The next stage was Manana. Manana means, they usually translate it as to think about it, to muse about it. It doesn't really mean that. I would say it is to consider. And you know, I use the word consider in this special sense. It's the word is derived from the Old English con, which is a finite form of the word kanan, which means to regard studiously, to study very carefully. That is the con part of it. And the siddha part is the Latin sidus, sidus sideris, a star. And a star being a self-shining light. To consider means to look at the self-shining light involved in what you are trying to know or understand. And that self-shining light actually lies within you yourself. It doesn't come from outside. I may be speaking perhaps rather too strongly, but nobody is able really to consider in that sense unless he is far advanced. Because that self-shining light is clouded, it's occluded, hidden by clouds. These clouds are born of our conditioning, our psychical conditioning, psychological conditioning. The mind and the heart being heavily conditioned from birth onwards prevents us from being able to be aware in terms of that self-shining light which is within ourselves. That self-shining light is really our own innermost consciousness. Our innermost consciousness, of which the brain is quite unaware. It doesn't know it. If somebody tells another person about it, that person may start thinking, now how shall I get hold of this self-shining light? He'll never do it that way. It is there. It has to be allowed to function. It is in the Sahasrara Chakra, talking in yogic terms, the thousand-petaled lotus. They say that that is the point of contact with Shiva himself, the third person of the Trinity. I have talked about it in the last chapter of Thor, in the chapter on meditation. This diagram itself is an attempt to present the whole yogic process in a very simple form, simple and comprehensible form. But this Sahasrara Chakra is the one which is the apparatus for the light of transcendence to function through you. And when the psychophysical organism is purified, then that light will influence the brain, and the brain will then sooner or later give rise to thoughts, concepts and words which more or less convey that transcendent reality. The supreme knowing, because the word consciousness really means knowingness. Con again, shas, the shas comes from skire, to know, and nas, the ness, merely gives a formulation of that. Consciousness is knowingness, and the consciousness of that, of the primordial creative energy which produces the universe, is an absolute consciousness. But that absolute consciousness, in the process of creating a material, a manifested universe, became more and more clouded, just as its creative energy became more and more concretized, until finally it produced solid matter, and then the turning point came, and the upward movement back to its source started. And in the human being on this planet is the greatest possibility for realizing that. There is no other creation on the planet, anyway, that I know of, which can do this. It is for us human beings. So, manana really means to consider. How will you learn to consider? We have to start within the ordinary way of our thinking process, which is, if you like, an argumentative process. Step by step, you reason out the thing. You see? And if you reason out the thing rightly and successfully, you become free of so much conditioning which prevents clear seeing. You see, this is very important. And as that happens, your ability to remain silent also grows. The power of silence grows at the same time. Now, when the Shravana and the Manana have developed to the right extent, and no one can measure that right extent, because whatsoever happens to you happens uniquely to you, because you are unique. No one can lay down anything for you. Wake up to your uniqueness. This is absolutely essential. when it has arrived at the right state, then the third crowning part of the whole business is what is called nididhyasana. Nididhyasana. This is ordinarily translated as meditation. Now the word meditation doesn't really convey in the English language, or samadhi in Sanskrit doesn't really convey the nature of this nididhyasana. Look, when one has come to that point where one can really become silent and really become aware of that inward shining light, the inner light which is yours, you see, then when that comes to its climax, you enter the true meditative state. I have spoken of this once before, at least in our group meetings. Last year, I think I spoke about it. That true, you enter the true meditative state. That is to say, you are conscious in the context of infinity and eternity. You have transcended, you have freed yourself from the context of the finite and the temporal, which is the mortal state. Whatsoever is finite and temporal is mortal. You see, it comes into being, it has its span, lifespan, and it passes away. It gives place to something else, you see. Now that is not the real meditation. That is why all these laid down meditations, these systematized meditations, are meditations which are kindergarten stuff, which are useful, mind you. They are useful because they can help you to learn to concentrate in the right way. In the right way. Up to a point only. Because there comes, in this type of taught meditation, what happens is that you exclude everything but that which you have that matter which you have selected to meditate upon. You see? But you see, we are organic spiritual wholes. And the entire universe is an organic spiritual whole. It's a unitary whole. And if in our own consciousness we try to exclude what we do not want, we are not really meditating. The true samadhi, which means the supreme togetherness, means that you are at one with this state in clear consciousness, remember. This is where I think most of the Christian mystics have fallen short. They say, this is given unto you by the grace of God and it lasts only for a little bit. That is not so. You can enter into that state for as long as you please. You see? But mind you, that has to be qualified by the fact that because you are alive in a physical body, that long as you please will probably never exceed 7 days and nights at a stretch. The Buddha himself said this about himself and so forth. It won't exceed that. You see? Because the body must feed, it must assimilate, it must eliminate, and so forth, you see. So 7 days and nights is as long as the body will do it. And then after that, you better wake up and just come down to the ordinary earthly level again. So now, this nididhyasana, when you enter that meditative state, you are in a state of complete silence where the entire worldly process is concerned. That is to say, the mortal process of the finite and the temporal. All experiences, all that comes to you through the sense avenues and so forth, that becomes completely pacified. Remember, you do not suppress it. This is where scholars, both Indian and European, have made a mistake. I don't know whether the mistake originates with the old writers in Sanskrit, the people of India themselves. But they say, you suppress this, that and the other. You suppress nothing. You are completely open to the inflow of transcendence out of the totality of the universe. And through you it passes, and it goes back out to the universe. This is the reality. I think I have mentioned that also in the last chapters in Thor. You see? It's rather funny that whoever has talked about this book or tried to review it has missed out all the really fundamental and important points, which are scattered through the book, but still, there we are. Now, so when you enter into that meditative state, then you are no longer separate from the totality. You are one with the totality. So much so that the Upanishadic seers openly declared, Aham Brahmasmi. Aham, I, Brahma, Brahman, the absolute all, Asmi, am. And Brahma and Asmi together make Brahmasmi. You see, Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. Now, of course, especially in modern times and in the Western world, that sounds extraordinarily conceited. But now, if to the Western world or any world, God, let us use the word God because it is a delightful little monosyllable, you see, God came along and introduced himself and said, I am God. What would the people do? They'd lock him up if they could. If they could. Seeing the man is mad. But that is the truth. You do become that in consciousness. And after all, who else can look into your consciousness? Excepting another person who has realized the same truth. So now, that was, I have tried to present very briefly and I think somewhat inadequately what happened in the process of the teaching by the Brahman teacher and the process of learning by the pupil who went to him.